Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. My name is Alex Q, and welcome to the third episode of Miscast. Strata Genius.
I always look forward to those.
Yeah, it's getting harder and harder to think of actually ones that aren't complete rubbish. But anyway, this is the third episode in a short series where each episode we discuss tabletop topics that we hope will help improve your generalship, expertise, and enjoyment of your gaming experience. Ooh. It's the podcast that will talk nonsense and sense, and it's the podcast that's found out about the origin of Viagra this week. It's that kind of podcast. Any comments about Viagra, people?
I've never used it, but I think I would, because my girlfriend's lucky she gets two pumps and an apology nowadays.
Wow.
Any comments, Owen, about Darren's relationship?
I mean, I probably quite like it, because I play Warhammer on hard mode, so maybe...
Oh, there we go. Here he is.
Maybe the Viagra will help me in my... Other kind of games.
Oh, BOC hard mode nowadays. Are they not the actual cream?
Hey. my goats and my cows are safe in a box.
I don't mind. I think you deserve it after like ripping a whole season with Nagash.
Nagash. I want to play OBR. That's what I want to play. Just because, you know, I'm a very reactive player, and why not play an army that can't react in any way? That makes sense, right?
I like to pop a couple and then chant that famous Rage of Sigmar saying, "And we're back."
Yeah,
it's going to be that kind of podcast. Everyone listening, it just is.
I mean, anyone else? You set the tone, Alex.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Anyone else know the origin of Viagra? Just out of interest,
I don't know the origin. No, pray tell.
So they were looking into it to try and help heart disease, and all the guys, when the nurses came back, were lying on their fronts, and some very sensible nurse thought, why are all the men lying on their fronts when we come back? That's because they all had erections. So there you go. Origin of jazz. Jazz? God, I've got jazz on the mind, Owen. Origin of Viagra. Anyway, should we get into our episode? So you can hear my first sexy co-host serenades as last time. He goes by @positivevictim on Twitter, and he's officially launched his professional coaching service.
I have, so professional.
And coaching for all your intimate tabletop needs. It's Darren Watson. Hi, Darren.
Hello, gorgeous.
You all right?
Yes, yeah, I'm a little hungover. I went to a party yesterday, which was, it's an annual thing, actually, Ridley Fest, they call it. It's a large garden. The chap himself, Joe, is a gardener, so his garden was absolutely glorious. I was there for 20 minutes and I got red knees. So I spent the whole party trying to avoid the sun because I don't often go outside.
Did you get sunburned on your knees from 20 minutes?
I was going to say, what did you get red knees from, Darren? Normally that's something else.
Do you want to hear a red knee story?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a gay bar in Portsmouth. Brilliant. Called, yeah. What's it called? HB. It's a famous one. And we often go there because it's fucking loads of fun. But one night I was particularly drunk. So please excuse this story. It's not gonna show me in the best light. And I am ashamed of it. But at the time I was only in my 20s, so I could excuse myself.
It's fine. I can edit it out afterwards if it's a problem. Oh, no.
Well, basically, I was having a lot of fun on the dance floor and I was dancing around and there was a group of women. I can't presume they were all lesbians. But one of them, they were dancing around a handbag and I picked it up and I started to dance around it because my mother, that's her favourite thing to do, is put her bag on the dance floor and then she likes to two-step with her arms outstretched like she's an aeroplane. So it's her favourite dance, you know, it's very mumsy. So I was trying to emulate that, but in the middle of a nightclub, obviously very drunk. So they took umbrage to this and they tried to get their bag back, obviously, mm-hmm. which is absolutely fine. And I didn't know what was going on. And basically, Freddie's growling. He doesn't like this story either. I've had to go in the front room because I'm hungover. So is my girlfriend, Alex. She's in the bedroom. She's kicked me out. But anyway, there was a bit of a to-do with this bag and their items fell on the floor. And then obviously there was a large group of women all very angry at me. So my friend came over to calm it all down. And I said, look, ladies, I'll buy you all a Jager bomb. Or rather, my friend Wayne told them I'd buy them all a Jager bomb. So I went to the bar. I ordered, I don't know, 5 to 6 Jager bombs. And then I turned around. I don't know why I did this, but I said, oi. And then I proceeded to down all the Jager bombs in front of them. that set them off again. And I got chucked out. I got chucked out of the bar about, it must be about 11:30. And anyway, none of my friends followed me because obviously it's completely my fault. And I was, a massive tit and I did deserve to be chucked out. Later that evening, I get in back to the house where I live with Rick Meyer at the time, about 3 a.m. in the morning. And they're like, so this is a good, what's that? One, that's a good 4 hours. No one's seen me. And they've been in since 2:30. And I come in all disheveled. I'm in my shorts and I've got these bloody knees. They're like, where have you been? What have you been doing after being kicked out of a gay bar?
Where's my going, Darren?
Well, I was like, in the morning, because when I got in, I was paralytic. Obviously, in the morning, I was like, what the hell's going on with my knees? But I think what's happened is that I've fallen over because my phone was smashed. I've fallen over onto my knees. That's what I think what's happened. But everyone else thinks someone's had a great time with me or I've given them a great time, one or the other. But yeah, that's my naughty knee story.
Wow. That was a journey.
The end of that was much better than I thought it could have been. So that was great. Thanks, Darren. Darren, yeah, coaching service. We should shout it out, really. How's it going? How's it been? How's your clientele? How are they all doing?
I think it's going rather well. I mean, I've always been super reluctant to do this, but since like 2017, people often ask me questions at that time it was how to get the most out of Croak because I was doing quite successfully with Croak. And I think I've built up a bit of a reputation for being helpful. So people often will come to me with list ideas, you know, from all levels as well. People that are just getting into the hobby, right the way up to people that are on international teams. I've even been on, you know, Skypes with teams, you know, trying to give them some tips on doing pairings and deployments and list builds and team builds. But I've always done that for free, you know, sort of in my spare time. But it was getting to the point where I was getting sort of two or three people a day asking questions. It doesn't sound like a lot, but if you want to do a good job for someone, say someone says to you, is this a good list? Then you think to yourself, I think to myself, right, what's your local meta like? Are you a proactive? Are you a reactive player? You know, what experience have you got with the list? What are your goals for the list? Are you going to any events? You know, there's quite a lot of work that goes into these questions. So those two or three people would turn into like 2 to 4 to 5 hours a day thinking about everyone's lists. And it was getting to the point where I'd be in the supermarket with my girlfriend and we enjoy shopping together. And she'll be wittering away at me, and not wittering away. That's derogatory, isn't it? She'll be enthusiastic.
She listens, it's fine.
but my mind's elsewhere, you know, and that was happening. Yeah. That was happening more and more. I should be able to compartmentalize. Is that the right term? Mm-hmm. My Warhammer and my, because she's got no interest in the hobby whatsoever. I just want to be a better boyfriend, basically. And also, I struggle with sleep, so it's getting to the point where it was. People's questions were sort of playing on my mind, and yeah. People have often told me that I shouldn't be doing so much for free. So initially I started, I've got a little, a coffee link in my Twitter bio for people that if they are appreciative, they can send some money, but it's certainly not something that you need to do. Cause I'm very reluctant to make Warhammer pay to play. But this is a step I've taken to try and manage my time as well, because on the coffee link doesn't work because some people send nothing, which is absolutely fine. Some people send way too much for my time. So it's just a nice way of saying, right, if you'd like some help, here's the amount of time that I can give to you. Here is a cost so that I can control the cost. I don't think it's too much. And I've asked a lot of people what they think I should be charging to arrive at that cost. A lot of people think I should be charging more, but like I say, I don't want to make it pay to play. And we've got 30 patrons at the moment, and I think we're having a good time of it. I've opened a Discord, which I've got.
And if people listening want to join your community, how do they go about doing it?
You can message me on Twitter. There's a link in my bio. It's patreon.com/onwardsAOS. What a pretentious twat. And there we've got like in the Discord, like I run like monthly list challenges. The first one, for example, is I've written a Nighthaunt list because like a meta relevant problem. And the challenge is to create the best counter to that list, so we can get everyone discussing, you know, Nighthawk counters for the month. And then the best one gets to cream me on TTS, hopefully. So I get to learn a bit about TTS.
Oh, that sounds good. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself, how do we teach people to recognize a problem in the meta and then go about solving it right? So we can't do it with just one person's opinion. So it's best to get loads of different people's opinions in a pot. And then I'm going to get someone else to choose. Maybe you'd like to do it, Alex, if you don't mind reading their explanations of why they think this are good. If I pick it, I'm just going to pick the one that I can beat, right? Because I fucking hate losing.
I hadn't gathered that at all, Darren. No.
It's funny you say that, Darren. I didn't realize you were doing that on your Patreon, because that's what I've been doing all week, is trying to write anti-Nighthaunt lists.
Wow. You're welcome to join, Owen. The minimum is £5 a month.
I think it's this long. I think it's a very relevant at the moment. Yeah, they're a pretty good army.
Alex, I think it's going very well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, I'm very glad to hear. I think it's really useful. So if people want to join, there you go. Go and join Darren's community, and maybe you'll get to play him on TTS. But enough of us chatting. And we just heard him get in, so it's a good segue. It's only the sexy sock seductor himself. You can find him at who has the sexiest socks ? On Instagram. He's at OJ180 on Twitter. It's the Owen Jackson. Hi, Owen.
Hello. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. We're recording this on Sunday morning in the UK, and it's actually hot already, which for everyone else listening around the world is like, who cares? It's UK hot. But when the UK gets hot, it's a nightmare because there's no aircon anywhere, and we're just lame with heat. So
mine's segue, Alex, but you know that next weekend when I've grudged you round one, it's supposed to be 43 degrees and we're playing outside.
You're joking.
So I'm going to melt your brain and your models.
Oh my God. I know. 43.
Yeah.
I mean, our final guest, who we've heard a bit of, will just be just laughing because this is nothing to him. I'm sure.
I'm very well. Thank you. I had a very positive day yesterday where I'm calling it Cathartic Day. Cathartic Day?
Does Cathartic that work? Cathartic Day.
Saturday is called a Cathartic Day. Now.
Cathartic Day. Yeah, it sort of does. Yeah. Because you didn't go to a tournament?
I didn't go to a tournament.
What the fuck?
I know. It's great, actually. It felt weird for a bit, but it's great. Now I basically just sort of got all my collection of stuff out and decided how much of it I'm going to sell or give away or, you know, consolidating down the collection, cleaning up my hobby room, sort of clearing out my brain a little. Felt good. So that was my day. But in general, good. Yeah, had a really quiet week. I got COVID, which wasn't very good. And I did the world thing at Rob Symes's, which was his venue, which was great. Met some nice people and played some really tough games. And I got 100% more wins with Nagash than at the UK Championships. So that was good.
Football.
It was still only two wins. But now heads in the new edition, which is quite bewildering. But I would say 7.9 out of 10 this morning, Alex. There you go.
Very specific. I like it.
Yeah, that's me at the moment. Which is really
was your clearing up? Was your clearing up successful? You're like who's the lady in the UK that does all the clearing up stuff?
Not Trini and Susanna, I hope.
No, not Trini and Susanna.
you mean Marie Kondo?
That's the one. You Marie Kondo'd yourself.
I did. Marie Kondo-ing myself sounds like I've been doing something very different. But
that's good. Well, I started off asking about the origins of Viagra. That's fine.
Hey. A lot of it doesn't bring me joy.
A couple of bloody knees.
I got a lot of stuff. You know what it's like. We love this hobby, and you go, ooh, shiny, and you get.
Have you got tons of? Are you a hoarder? Are you a hobby hoarder?
Yeah. I'm currently I'm looking to my left, and I can see 15 really useful boxes full of sprue. But I've also listed a load of stuff on some chats, and then people have been interested, and I've gone, some of it's broken, and I've kind of changed my mind. So I'm having even before it's sold, I'm having remorse. I can't let go. I might get rid of. I've got my original fantasy metal dwarf army, which I don't know. I think it might be nice to get rid of it, but. Yeah, so having a big clear out, I put all my white dwarfs in the recycling. I know that sounds terrible, but I ripped all the little articles or the paint guides that I liked. But I tell you what my favorite thing is, and people should definitely do this, is, and I'll stop rambling then. My favorite thing at the moment in the hobby is when you know a new battle tome is coming out, I get the old one, and I love going down to the charity shop and it's almost like you're kind of, you're just waiting for some. So I put all my old battle tomes and GHBs. I give them all to the charity shop, and I just imagine some little kid going down there and being like, "Oh, what's this?" And then, being introduced to the world of Warhammer, and
their dad going, "It's an extinct game, son. We're not getting this."
Have you seen the prices? So that was my day yesterday. So I went and took more battle tomes to the charity shop and having a big clear out. So having a nice time.
Condo day. Condo No, I can't do it. I can't make one out of it.
I'm starting some volunteering down at the local St. Vinny's. I don't know if you guys have Vinny's at like Salvation Army.
Okay.
That sort of thing. This
you
week,
call it Vinny's. Is it Salvation Army? You guys call Vinny's?
We call St. Vinny's St. Vincent's St. Vinny's.
And
we call Salvation Army Salvos. And Harold Bishop was in the Salvos, if you like Neighbours fans.
Harold Bishop.
I'm starting at the Vinny's this
week. Is he still in the sea, Harold Bishop? Did he ever
I think he's dearly departed, isn't he? It's gotta be. I know I used to watch it like in the late 90s, and he was old then. Him and Lou were both old, so I don't know if they made it to the end. But yeah, my wish is that, or my hope is that while I'm there one day, just an old lead collection or an old white metal collection comes in. I mean, I'm happy to pay them, you know, eBay rates or retail rates or whatever for it, but just being the person that opens that treasure trove will be a reward in and of itself.
I like that. So I started off thinking this is going to be a selfless story.
No, God, no.
No, see, when I had
on my hands this term.
When I had a break just before uni, I had a really large Dark Elf collection from about fifth, sixth.
Did you burn it in the garden?
I didn't burn it in the garden. And I went to uni and I wasn't that bothered. And my parents, who were clearing stuff out, just thought it was rubbish. They took it to the local Vinny's or whatever, the local Samaritans. So someone out there, if you're listening, got an absolutely incredible collection for absolutely nothing, which was fully, it was, yeah. So good, to kudos, whoever's got that, good job.
Can I do great. One little request before we go to our wonderful guest, which is if anyone finds, can people tweet the podcast with like their best charity shop find? Because like Sam says, I've never found any, the only thing I've ever found in a charity shop is like Black Library novels, so you know. Screw that.
I found the Monopose second edition Space Marines. I think they used to come in like the painting sets, the starter sets. Everyone had them.
Okay,
about 20 years ago. So they're the only thing that I've spotted so far. But we'll keep an eye.
Still floating about.
But yeah, the best kind of like either car boot sale or charity shop find. I would love to be really jealous of that. But
A lot of stuff.
Also, Owen, we're at 387 followers, so you have 113 followers to go before the socks are released on the world.
Okay, I can do this. It's fine. I've got some time. Yeah.
I like the socks Sam sent us in the WhatsApp. You'll have to send me some of those.
We'll post them on online. Right.
Way too many years of corporate, so I reckon I've got 20 pairs of flamboyant and ridiculous socks that you're just supposed to see poking out between the dress shoe and the pant. I might get them out and take a group shot and send it to the pod, which I'm just about to follow on Twitter, which will get you one closer. As a rule, I don't like following things, but I'm gonna make an exception.
Well, let's introduce those sultry tones. So for those who don't know already, although most people listening probably do know who it is already, it's another Warhammer celebrity who, as we discussed before we started recording, has been on four shows. Mm-hmm. He's a gentleman whose musings can be found etched onto the stones travelling through the outback. He's a home favourite chatting out of Australia from That's Not a Knife, This is a Knife country. It's at AOS List Lab on Twitter. Age of Sigmar List Lab on the YouTubes. It's Team Australia's Sam Morgan, everybody. Woo-hoo! Hi, yes. Sam.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on. It's an honour.
We're the honours.
Yeah, it's great. You have been doing a bit of a world tour of Age of Sigmar content creators, haven't you? What was the last one? Weekly, wasn't it, you were on?
Yeah, I jumped on with Vince and Tom last week, which was really good fun to talk about my pet army, Skaven. Unfortunately, much to my dismay, they're maybe a little too good at the moment. I like to play with the off-meta stuff, and I can see the Skaven being quite popular for quite a while.
Yeah, I've been looking at them myself, and this was really fun. And I saw your to mention that, I saw your tweet that you saw daughters, and you were like, no, they're way too good, they're gone. just gone.
Yeah, that was sad. I was in this situation, right? I had two Daughters armies and one Gloom Spite army. So the reason I had two was I had this army to use while I was building my own army. So I bought a fully painted and built one secondhand, and got a couple of practice games in with them, and they're fantastic army. They're just blenders, and in this current GHB, I think they're going to do particularly well because that they have the capacity to run the veterans who can take out the opposing threats, but equally are quite durable themselves, so that there's less of a risk of having battle tactics or even scenario points scored against you for losing your GVs. But anyway, so I had the two Daughters of Cain army. I had one Gloom Spite army, and I sold the built Daughters of Cain. The same day I bought the Gloom Spite army. So I now have one Daughters army and two Gloom Spite army. So that's good. Did the flip.
Yeah. It's I saw lots of people, most people were commenting about like just the battle tactics for Daughters.
Yeah. The battle tactics are comically easy. Like, there's one of them, two units need to use the rule on their war scroll, and there's no condition for using the rule. Like,
oh, the heart renders one. Yeah.
You just automatically get it. And then the witch elves, you want them in combat. And then they've got an ability to pretty easily score some of the ones from the GHB as well. So, yeah, it comes down to this point where you delete their army and you can reliably score 5 out of 5. My friend Marcella, who was on the US team, Little Marathi on Twitter, she's been to like 5 events in the last 6 weeks. She's doing her best Owen Jackson impression. And every week she's just saying, got every battle tactic. And over in the States, the price support is insane. So she's I think she's able to quit her job and just live off the prices she's winning.
You can just get prize money and live. Because I know the 40K pros.
Like so much. Like, so it's nuts. Yeah.
Wow.
What Marcella gets for a one dayer at like a battle bunker would be bigger than the prize you get for winning CanCon, the biggest event in the world.
That is bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah, that is nuts. Well, that's a good lead in as we're talking a bit about strategy already. So for those who didn't get my amazing title, this episode is about strategy, and it's about strategy in general. Obviously, battle plans dictate things, lists dictate things, but just overarching strategy. And last time, thank you for all of you that sent messages in to the Miscast pod, but also to private Twitter feed. And lots of people saying they found it really enjoyable to listen to our expert hosts and guests talking about what they do. So I think to kick us off, Sam, if we start with you, strategy, just in general, what does strategy mean to you? Do you plan your strategies before every event you go to? Basically, we talk about your plans, how are you going to win the game? Is it something that has evolved over time for you, or do you find that actually you do very similar play styles, so actually strategy for you now comes kind of second nature, or is it something you have to kind of work on, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a reasonably layered question, so I'll try and address as much of it as possible, but feel free to pull me absolutely back on course if need be. Yeah. So, for me personally, I've had the misfortune of oscillating between jobs, between project work, which I really enjoy, and then like strategic advisor, strategic leader, strategic planner work, which is all about having a sense of what does your next horizon look like, whether that's 3 months, 12 months, 3 years, 5 years. It's going to vary depending on the size of the organization and the work, but it's really about setting some attainable goals and then working out a path in order to achieve those. And then understanding what the risks are in delivering on the work program and how you might mitigate those risks and how you might ensure that you're going to succeed. So that to me translates directly into Age of Sigmar. It's like, what's my path to victory? That's my objective. How am I going to win this? How am I going to win with this particular army? And then what are all the things that I need to be conscious of in terms of what are the armies in the meta that I'm likely to face? What are the scenarios from the GHB which I'm likely to play? What are the counters that exist to my list? What are the prevailing threats? And doing that environmental scan. And once you understand that, then and playing to the strength of your book and your build. So for me, what I try and do is determine that path to victory in as agnostic a way as possible. So that means that sometimes my path to victory might be by playing incredibly defensively and stopping my opponent from scoring, depriving them of whatever they're good at. Sometimes it'll be about running headfirst in and trying to kill their army. Other times it might be about playing for a mid game or a late game. So determining that my army, for instance, Daughters of Cain, my army becomes buffed consecutively throughout the game. There's force multiplication happening in turns 4 and 5. That's when I'm going to go and score. It does certainly vary from one list to the next. And we were talking off air earlier about when you're introduced to the hobby, and you might be at your local games workshop, or you might be playing some 1,000-point games or whatever it might be. I think the natural inclination at that point is to have two armies charge headlong into the middle of the field, and the win condition for both players is I'm going to nuke their stuff. And I feel like that win condition becomes more nuanced the more you play and the higher you get through the table. So you might find once you're a little bit more experienced, you start to think, hang on a tick, I don't want to sacrifice and trade because this person's army has more output, but I have more durability, or I have more speed, or I have more optionality. And you know, utilizing all of the things that you've got at your disposal rather than just trying to fight head first, that becomes a really significant factor.
Yeah, and I like the bit you mentioned about the environmental scan. It's similar to what Darren mentioned last episode about seeing kind of what the meta picks are and what kind of the best deployment would be to go in to stop the dragons, I think was the example last time. How are the best to do that? So for you, those different play styles, are you picking the play style before you pick the faction, or are you picking a faction and then coming up with a play style that fits your play but also that faction? What's the order of that for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it really varies from one book to the next. Sometimes you'll read a book and a particular unit will stand out and you'll say, that's what I'm going to build around. And the dragons are an obvious example of that. For Owen, it might be Nagash, and your win condition might be, how do I optimally use Nagash? And that's things like... at a micro level, it's like, I need to get reroll to cast so I can mitigate miscast. So I need that cog. So I'm not just buying Nagash, I'm buying Nagash and cogs. And then you'll say, well, actually, I also need the portal because I want the extra reach. Even if I don't intend on using Hand of Dust as a threat, what I want to do is create a buffer around my army, a zone where characters won't come in because they're scared of the threat of the Hand of Dust. Then what can I do to ensure that I've still got scoring units? So you start to look at, you know, well, is it worth going zombie spam, or do I want to go more tech guard? And then you can look at what army you actually pivot into that way. And your whole army is built around this win condition of either trading Nagash for a win, or Nagash surviving long enough that you win because of his output. So that's something that does also vary Army and based on the units at your disposal. Like, I've run stuff in the past where not a single unit in my army was good individually, but in chorus that there was this synergy going on, and that they were sort of able to support each other. So I think that's something worth exploring as well. What are the force multipliers at my disposal? Because it's not an aggregate thing with Warhammer. It's not like my aspiring champion who's an 80-point hero in my Khorne army. My aspiring champion is a five wound, 4+ save hero. Like, on paper, that's not a lot of inherent value. But when you factor in the +1 attack command ability he has, and the fact that can then couple with other abilities, like there's multiple abilities for +1 to attack, and then you factor in that you might be running something like Chaos Knights, and they've got 2 attack profiles, the horse and the rider. You know, all of this stuff, you're sort of building a bit of a layer cake. And that's part of the appraisal as well, because I think that's when you can find some of the hidden gems. And that's certainly, in terms of Darren's Discord and in terms of Darren's approach to list building, that's certainly one of the things that you'll see come through in terms of you know, unearthing those hidden gems and utilizing them. Because sometimes it's how you spent the last 80 points or how you spent the last 100 points in your list that ultimately is the difference between your game and your opponent's game.
Yeah, sure.
It's also the most fun. Discovering those, isn't it?
Yeah,
certainly for me.
And you say you're. I mean, I've seen quite a few of your lists in throughout the years, Sam. And did you think it's fair to say that you are one of these players that go for the kind of these synergy style lists, and therefore your play is revolved around those kind of buff ranges and those kind of synergies? And if so, how did you find out that is what your play style is? Because lots of the questions we have been getting is, mm-hmm. well, I don't know if I'm an aggressive player or a defensive player or a reactive, et cetera, et cetera. So was there a moment for you that you suddenly thought, oh, this is for me, this is what I'm good at?
Yeah, it's not like an inherent thing. So it's just reps, just playing lots of games and getting a feel for what I enjoy playing. And that's not to say as well that I haven't just run very point-and-click armies over a number of years. Like I've run some of the strongest builds in multiple different systems, unashamedly. But I can't do it for like a prolonged time because I don't find it as engaging or as interesting.
Yeah, sure. Darren, uh-huh. strategy. Same question, I guess, to you. So your strategy is how you go about. I'm assuming it's pretty similar to Sam's in a lot of ways, but. I know you mentioned a little bit about it in our deployment episode with your, as I said, like the environmental scans, but how do you go about kind of planning your strategy before you go to, I don't know, Worlds or any big tournaments you go to?
I try to make it as simple as possible. mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of practice at the top sort of levels with the minds that we've got in the scene. I think there's a lot of procrastination and there's a lot of overcomplication of the game. So I'm a simple man, so I come up with simple plans. They're the ones that suit me best. I adhere to a couple of very core principles. You'll have heard me go on about them before, I'd imagine. For an example, kill what you can. like when you're so target priority is mm-hmm. you know, what's the first, this sort of links in with what Sam was saying, that how do I get my path to victory? I've got like a very simple plan in most cases, which will be my order that I like to try and kill my opponent's pieces. So I'll start with quite often their support pieces, so they're like five wound heroes that have got mm-hmm. one cast, rather than trying to put all my damage into the screaming bell. You know, I'll try and kill the little rats that are behind the screaming bell, because it has an immediate impact on the game and an immediate impact on your opponent. They're taking toys off. I will then try and kill the the support units, you know, so that little unit of five, like that little unit of 10 skinks that's holding an objective, you know, once they're gone, people will often put, well, it depends on what list they're running, but people will often have some low value minimum resource units that are their backfield protectors. And I've run a lot of armies that can summon or can teleport. So if I can kill their 70-point skink unit that's holding that home objective, later on I can teleport onto it. So it forces your opponent to put a bigger piece of their resources onto that objective if they want to hold it. You know, if I'm ever fighting more tribes, I'm trying to kill like the little three ogres. Once mm-hmm. they're dead, they've then got to commit a Stonehorn to go and look after that objective. If they want to keep it right, if you've got some teleporting threats. So that's just an example of the sort of impact that killing those little support units can have on a game.
Yeah, sure.
Which can be a lot bigger than if you were to just say, I'm going to start killing your support pieces. Why are you targeting those little bits? So I try to pick apart an army.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that is, you know, just a very simple, very simple ploy, right?
Yeah, and in a game where, you know, obviously it's based on objectives, you know, it doesn't matter if you've got two Stonehorns, but there are six objectives, right?
Because mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. you've picked off the small units and the support units. And is that always a way that you've approached this game? Or, again, was there a moment that...
I think it definitely comes with experience. Like I did try to overcomplicate it in my youth. I'd spend hours, you know, thinking about all these really complicated plays, which is where my love of making complicated lists sort of comes up. But I think when it boils down to it, you're just trying to make the simplest plans are the easiest to run. And you can then just sit back and watch your opponent try and unfold their super complicated plans. The more cogs you put into a machine, then the more can go wrong. Is that the law of entropy? Is that right?
Oh, no, there you go.
You guys, I'm not a learned man, and then he just starts dropping. Dropping it in.
Only from Australia, Darren. We can't confuse him like that.
But yes, I think... Well, go on.
I think to Darren's point, there is this general notion, right, that you have depleting resources as the game moves on. So you both obviously start off with your armies and you set up and you deploy, and that's a discrete phase of, you know, this setup for the game where you're both trying to execute. Then you have this mid game where you're following your plan and you're both actually trying to both win the game yourself and stop your opponent from winning concurrently. And then at the end of the game, there's this sort of scramble for points. But what we're seeing at the moment with armies like Beasts of Chaos, Soul Blight, Nurgle, Legion of the First Prince, Seraphon, there's this incredibly valuable strategy that you can employ, which is around late game scaling and having summoning in your army, actually, instead of depleting, getting larger as the game plays out. And I'm sure Owen experienced this with his Worlds build. You just sort of swarm the board. Your opponent's losing units while you're gaining units, and the disparity just becomes massive.
Yeah. And I play into that play style. Like, I used to play Branch Wraith summoning builds, you know, throwing dryads around the board. I love recursion, and I always, whenever I play an army that doesn't have summoning, I mean, I think Rally maybe mitigates that a little bit now, but whenever I play armies that don't summon, I'm a bit like, wow, I think you have to play unless they're super powerful armies that, you know, maybe Alpha Strike armies or whatever, but I think you have to play really well with those armies that scale down rather than scale up. So it's the summoning crutch is real. I love
it. It's a bit too much, I feel, at the moment. But
Beast is mad. Yeah, Beast is nuts, especially into the new edition with the fact that you can summon Galatian veterans onto the board. Like, they're in a really good place. Thank you, pardon, Darren.
It's why you put them in a box. They're too good now. You're just a sadist, aren't you, Owen?
Yeah.
I'm quite glad you mentioned, you said the words late game scaling, Sam, because I mean, I play and watch a lot of League of Legends, and a lot of the strategy in that game, albeit it's esports rather than tabletop, but a lot of the overarching strategy for those teams revolves either a very strong early game, so get in, literally blitz your opponent, I guess a bit like an alpha in our game, or go for this late game scaling, as these strategies. And so I guess that might well be transferable to ours, whether you play these, you know, these alpha style, really aggressive, really essentially blitz your opponent early, win the game within the turns 1 to 2, or actually play these late game scaling ones where actually you just outtrade because you have more units into 4 or 5. And so that's that part of this environmental scan you were talking about, right? That actually you feel that the game's in that kind of late game scaling stage. Cool. That's a hard sentence to say. And so actually maybe people's strategy should be looking towards the kind of that late game, do you think? Is that fair to say?
It's interesting because there's three separate ways to score. So you can score based on the metrics of the particular mission, so 1, 2 more or whatever it might be, and then you can score your battle tactics, and then you can obviously score your grand strategy. So it sort of is going to vary from one matchup and one mission to the next. But if you're keeping an eye on depriving at least a couple of early game battle tactics for your opponent, and keeping an eye on what their grand strategy is. And often when you're playing a game, your opponent will say to you in turn 4, so they've got two turns left, oh, what was your grand strategy again? And it's like, you actually need to be thinking about that a lot earlier, particularly if there are units that you can be prioritizing or targeting to score it. And you often have this situation where even if you're behind on points, and this was particularly true when I was playing Seraphon, you'd be behind on points early in the game, but you would know, I'm going to table this person turn three, and then I'm going to score my battle tactics 4 and 5. I'm getting my grand strategy and they're not, and I'm going to hold all the objectives those turns. So I'm going to win this even though I'm behind early. And for some armies, they don't have that. Like Iron Jaws need to score their points early because once they're dead, they've got no avenue to score. So it does really vary.
Yeah, it's interesting that I like the point you made about the grand strategy as well. Like when I'm going back to the beasts that I took to Worlds, I played a lot of practice games and people were, didn't maybe talking about the grand strategy denial turn three, but nearly every single game, my opponents, even though I was surreptitiously distributing tokens because I was playing Predator's Domain. So controlling all the terrain. And I had these little surreptitious sort of whales tokens that I would distribute out onto the pieces of terrain as I took them. And, not calling out what they were. I don't know if that's naughty or whatever, but anyway. I'd probably say 5 out of 6 games, my opponent was gunning for that grand strat turn one, even so definitely it's that kind of environmental scan. I really like that term, in terms of, the environment of the meta, but also, in game, the in-game scan, like understanding what your opponent's pieces are and what his or her route to victory is. And then building that denial strategy. Like I think the strategy of denial is massive, and that's why I think that conversation around White Dwarf and Battletome battle tactics is an interesting one, because you need to understand what your opponent's trying to do in order to be able to deny it. So there's a lot of a lot of planning and a lot of knowledge that you need to build on all the armies and how they want to win the game.
Yeah, and I know we're not critiquing the game design, but there's nuance in the language as well. So understanding when it says starting army, understanding when it says something like, for instance, Ideneth have a battle tactic. Ideneth units kill two enemy units. Well, if you've allied in dragons or if you've allied in whatever, and they're the ones that are doing the killing, that doesn't count towards the battle tactic. And there's a level of nuance there, which I think is just purely preparation and practice. They're the only ways you're gonna actually have that information. And for me, I just jump on Wikipedia. Like I jump on Wikipedia at the start of the game and I go, I'm playing against Cities of Sigmar. They're going to have a turn where they can put two standard bearers within an inch of an objective and get a free battle tactic. And if they've got flagellants, I might target them turn one, even though they're hopeless, because they can get a free battle tactic by getting onto an objective in the opposing territory. So I know straight away, those are the two things that I need to remember. That's the mental load on top of the ones I already know for myself because I get to use them. Depending on the level of play, those might be written down. So I've got the thing to jog my memory. Or like we're early on in a season at the moment, and if they're only going to be 6-month seasons, I may not even memorize them by December. So I might just have that page of the GHB open just to give me the mental cues.
And are you finding the different battle tactics for the different factions you're facing ever change your overarching strategy very much, or do you just end up tweaking it slightly, Sam, for that?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question. I do find for armies that are able to achieve them, and some armies, like for instance, Fire Slayers, I think have 6 battle tactics. That's really hard to try and prevent 6 battle tactics plus the however many in the book. There's just too many things going on there. So in some instances, the better option is just to focus on scoring your own. So how can I optimally try and score my own and hope that through depleting their army in the later turns 4 and 5, that it might become difficult for them to score them. And like in the current book, one of them is that your general kills a unit. So if their general is a support character, they're probably not going to achieve that. So you can strike it out. Or if you have an opportunity to kill their general before they achieve that one, you can strike it out and you can start to do like a process of elimination. And once you get them down that they don't have 5 that they can complete in total, and you think that you can complete all 5, you know you're going to be at an advantage there.
Yeah, absolutely. Owen, we mentioned a bit about your love for the kind of late game scaling type lists. And I know, and people that know you, we take the piss out of you all the time for it, but you get a hell of a lot of reps in, or have had a hell of a lot of reps over the last few years. For people either getting into it or people trying to go to tournaments, have you found things to or ways of winning the game that have changed for you since you started? Because I know the last few years you've been really, you know, playing a lot of games. There can't be many people in the world who played a lot more.
Yeah, singleton life is real, yo. Anyway, it's a funny one, really. Like everybody talking has kind of sparked a few thoughts, and much like how I think about the game, I did do some notes and I did do a bit of pre-planning for this episode, and I think I would just like my ideas on strategy, and maybe I don't think anything has changed in how I approach the game. I've just got better at it, both on the table and off the table. So I would say that my strategy is very much about front-loading information, like much like Sam described what he does for work. Is there are some parallels with what I do in terms of project management and strategy and art direction and stuff like that. So like I have kind of like a I've kind of broken it down to like a 4-point plan. So
oh, love it, love a good 4-point plan.
So I've got four kind of key tenets of like how I approach the game, which is basically understand, plan, practice, and consume. So effectively, much like the sort of the scan, as it were, when you use that term, Sam, it made me think of one of the new Alien film. What was it, Prometheus, where they like go and scan the alien ship. They kind of throw this drone thing up in the air and then it zooms off, kind of like, you know, laser scanning the whole ship and coming back with a big schematic. I think you need to do that for the game, really.
Did you just call Sam a drone? Is that what you just done?
No, I didn't. Sam would be the drone controller who's then processing all the information, not the drone.
Not the big bald alien.
Yeah. No, Sam would have built the amazing alien spaceship that the drone is scanning.
I see.
Actually, I think Sam would have built the counter to the drone. You would be able to scan him.
Oh, right. Wow. So essentially, I think that, you know, for the understanding part, you need to like understand the assets that at your disposal, so your army, and you need to understand like the arena of battle. So you need to understand the game, the missions, you know, all the tactics, all the things that have been touched on by the other guests. So I would say that understanding your assets from the understanding phase is like you need to get off book. You need to, you know, learn your army. You need to know what things hit and wound on. Obviously, there are things like monster bracketing and the odd weird clutch, you know, corner spell that you might never cast. But fundamentally, you need to know exactly what your army does. And then you can be creative with it. It's like, you know, I thought of the analogy of like an artist. You know, Jackson Pollock didn't start painting by like, you know, dribbling paint over in that sort of chaotic manner. You know, he would have started at art school where he was doing life drawing and, you know, drawing bowls of fruit and drawing the, you know, naked form. You know, like he got all of his core fundamentals in place, and that then allowed him to, you know, show off his creativity. So like getting off book, having all those tools, and then being able to think about strategy on the table is really important. And then on the sort of arena side of things, you need to learn the missions inside out, really, I would say. And that only comes from practice. You know, I've trying to get my head around the new GHB. I've been, you know, listening to some podcasts and, you know, I watched.
What other podcasts? How dare you, Owen?
The outrage. But I've kind of learned that there's only so much theory I can take on board. I need to play games, but definitely understand your army, understand the missions, try and understand what type of army you like, you know, understanding the meta as well. I mean, there's a lot there, but basically you need to tool yourself up. You need to give yourself like the ammo to succeed, you know, knowing threat ranges, knowing key pieces, much like what Darren talked about, you know, knowing the little support heroes or perhaps the little bits of chaff which are going to help, you know, their opponent in the late game. Basically understanding. Then you need to, and this is a little bit more holistic, but you need to like create like a bedrock for your success. So like when you go to tournaments, like think about logistics, think about somewhere like travel, make it nice, accommodation, you know, have a hotel just down the road that has breakfast. I know this sounds
Ooh, a bit I silly. Love outside factors, Owen.
I'm
I love
so
this.
Triggered right now. I'm my blood is boiling. which would have been really helpful when I was having cold showers at Top Hotel Praha.
Oh no. Whilst myself and the Welsh team were being serenaded by, you know, like live piano as we dined.
Oh, I saw this video. I'd love it if you post it for listeners, but there's a video of Team Wales where they were.
It was
going
a proper
downstairs.
Vibe, man. Our hotel was where they filmed Amadeus, which was the Mozart film from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone watched that. It was lovely. Anyway, but no, all of that outside stuff, you know, I think I don't want to talk too much, but basically I think that I'm if I was to appraise the way that I think about the game and my strengths as a gamer, like before I start rolling dice, I'm like a 10. When the game starts, I'm like a 6 or a 7, and then it evens out to about an 8. Like I'm a good 4-1 player. I know where I'm at. And a lot of that comes from all this pre-stuff. So, yeah, all the things to do with, you know, planning. Like I've got, you know, have a good case for your models, you know. Print off your own score sheets, have your dice and your tray. Like, have a system. Like, I don't know if I've done some stream games and stuff, but when you watch me play on stream, like, my dice and my tokens and everything are always in exactly the same place. And it feels weird when I'm not like that. Everything is off to my right, and I have these kind of like.
It's very, you know, Tony Moore-esque going.
It is, yeah. I've learned from Tony as well, you know, in terms of, you know, taking notes and. I've got my own bespoke score sheets with all of the battle tactics written out in with tick boxes. And if there's an extra VP available for doing it with a monster from last season, they would be bolded, whereas the other ones are light. And mm-hmm. at the start of every game, I would just sit there and cross it. Right, they've got no monsters. Bring it down. That's out. You know, they've, yep. I don't know, it's a really small deployment zone. So I'm going to just put a question mark on whether I'm going to be able to get Savage Spearhead. You know, take, for example, First Blood always had that little L-shaped deployment zone. And without a teleport, it would be like, right, am I going to be able to get in there? And obviously, summoned units couldn't get Savage Spearhead, et cetera, et cetera. So have your system, set yourself up for success, like have a plan for your deployment. Maybe there's an episode of a podcast you could listen to. If you
yeah,
want
I don't
to,
know. I don't know who's done it recently. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, prep all that up. And then from that point on, then you just, like, play the game. And playing the game leans into my third point, which would be practice. So, you know, the more that you play, the more that you know the rhythm of your army, you get faster. Your magic phases, you become clearer in your thinking. You know where to put your buffs. You know your auras. Like, I think Sorry, go ahead.
So, and orders, your order of things.
Yeah, well. Exactly. Your sequencing and all this stuff becomes, and the shape of your army, the visual of it. It's like, oh, yeah, this feels good. I've got all my stuff to one side. I've got, you know, I'm set. Boom, boom, boom. And then consume. I think, you know, there's lots of good stuff out there. If you want to learn, if you think to yourself, okay, my mate plays Khorne, my other mate plays Caradhron Overlords, and then that fella down the club that I play once a month, like he only ever plays Stormcast. It's like if you don't play a wide variety of armies, then, you know, consume these battle tome reviews. You know, there's 3 to 4 hours worth of content out there per, you know, like an Honest Wargamer or a Warhammer Weekly or a List Lab. Shout out, Sam. You know, lean into these people. You know, like I learned loads from other people who are better than me at the game. And then the last thing I would say is, and I was chatting to my mate Cole about this yesterday, another part of my strategy is like do other things as well. Like obsession and pressure aren't very good. Like you can go too deep down the rabbit hole and it can become a little bit toxic. And I found that, like, I had at the end of the season, I had a couple of tournaments after Worlds that I didn't really enjoy. And then I went to the Worlds last week with a much different attitude. And I was like, you know, cool, I'm going to get Nagash off turn one with long strikes. How poetic that my last game of the edition is that. And you know, I had a great time. So I definitely think, you know, getting away from screens and models and all this sorts of stuff is actually really, really helpful. You know, and if you're having a shit time with the game, like, talk to your friends about it and, you know, get a different perspective. That's my strategy. And then from that point on, it's creative problem solving, mitigating dice, and giving your opponents puzzles to solve. I always think that I play quite high drop armies, so I'm always set my castle up, set them up with a puzzle, how much you're going to come forward. And then from that point on, you know, I'm that reactionary player that then I work off what my opponent is giving me. I don't go in and blow them off the table. And then I use summons and recursion and tricks to then give me a little edge in the late game.
So your strategy is to react to what they're doing, essentially?
Generally, yeah, because I like playing castle builds, and I like, yeah, I think understanding what you like is another thing. I don't really, I think Darren did a really interesting set of articles a while ago on the Honest Wargamer about, you know, understanding your play style. And, you know, that's a huge part of strategy. Like, there's no point in chopping and changing armies and chopping and changing lists if you don't really know, you know, what you like. But yeah, definitely I'm that reactive counter style.
I've got three points from listening to you, Owen, if I may.
Yeah, please. Yeah, go on.
So your first point about having all your tokens in place and being all super prepared. And I have tried to be that player for fucking years, because I absolutely, that is the player I want to be, but I am just not organized. And I find when I've had all my tokens about and I've focused on putting my tokens down, I'm not focusing on the game because I've got a scatty as fuck brain. So for people out there, I just, you know, if you're not wired that way, then that potentially that's okay. Because I think I've accepted that about me. I'm not a particularly organized gamer. I'm not ever going to be able to, I'm just not ever going to be able to do that. And I've accepted that. And my games recently have been more relaxed without me trying to become someone I'm not. So that's just one thing. I don't think you have to be like that.
No.
Inclined is absolutely a massive advantage, but I don't think it's,
to clarify. Yeah. Sorry. I should maybe temper my
No,
only in such that I understand that that's what makes me successful, and yeah. I don't, you know, yeah, so just going to the point about what armies people like to play, I don't want people, you know, there's no point me, you know, if we came on the podcast and went like, Iron Jaws are the best, everyone has to play Iron Jaws, some people wouldn't enjoy it because it's not their play style. But all I'm with my kind of plan, it's more that I understand that that's what makes me successful. So I,
understand yourself. So that's the first point. The second point, you mentioned that you love playing all these castle builds. I would really recommend like playing something completely different so that you understand how you can maximize your chances against it. So I would just, you know,
that's exactly what I'm doing, Darren.
Perfect. You know, perfect.
And that's a really good point. Again, I'm watching people play like Eidneth Deepkin, for example, and like, you know, they're so fast, you know, with the sharks and the eels and the king. Like watching back some of the footage of, say, someone like Mike Stewart, who took Eidneth recently, or my teammate Dan Arnold, I'm looking at the table like, what the fuck? There's not a block of troops on your home objective, and it's worth 4 points to your opponent. Like, what are you doing? But that kind of aggro play style, you know, and pinning them in, etc. I agree with you.
You don't have to like it, but you can learn how to break it, right? And then my third point is on consume, I'm super disappointed you didn't just say, take Purple Sun.
Purple Sun, Purple Sun, right?
And Incarnate. You've got Incarnate as well.
I've played with Nagash Hand of Dust for long enough that I'm going to let everyone else have their auto kill fun for a little bit.
Good.
I think playing singles Warhammer, so 1v1, is lots of fun, and singles tournaments are fantastic. But those two units highlight the value of a team's landscape, don't they? And just that added level of puzzle solving and only having a 1 in 8 chance of coming up against them. Alex, I've sent you through my during game sequencing chart on the Twitter, so you can have a look and retweet that if you please. And it's to Owen's earlier point, because I think what Owen said, and this is, I'm going to distill it down to like a very brief sentence, is understanding yourself. So I'm similar to him. I gain a lot out of being planned and prepared, and I gain a lot out of having visual reminders. So I've sent through the tokens there, which emulate the ones that you use on TTS. And find on TTS, I've always got a really clear game sense because it's top down. And because everyone has tokens attached to units to say what their buffs were. And I've color-coded mine. So I've got yellow for heroic actions, red for debuffs, and then green for buffs. And I find that to be incredibly valuable as well. And I also get really frustrated when my opponent seemingly has moving buffs that are where they need to be at a particular point in time, regardless of who may have cast them or shoot them.
That is an issue, isn't it?
And sometimes that's inadvertent as well, I should say. Sometimes you say, I'm pretty sure I cast Mystic Shield on them, it makes sense, and then you're like, oh, actually maybe I didn't. the thing about balance, I think, actually genuinely makes you a better player, and as important and fun as Warhammer is to me in my life, I certainly perform better when I've got other things going on, and when I'm not a slave to this and sort of doing it because I'm obliged to. I'm doing it because it's fun and because I'm finding it relaxing and enjoyable.
Yeah, it should add to your life, shouldn't it, rather than be your life?
I've seen that picture, Sam. That's great. So, anyone listening, I will retweet Sam's picture with his color coding on our at Miscast Pod Twitter feed. So, if you want to have a look, check that out. That's great. For both of you, talking a lot about tokens and prep, and Darren's mentioned this before, that some people we play against get a lot of decision paralysis. Have you ever found that this prep, this meticulousness of trying to think of every kind of possible combo and everything else, has that ever disadvantaged you when you're trying to win the game? Has that ever been a disadvantage? I'll start with you, Sam. Has that ever affected you negatively? Do you think, where you thought, oh my God, I can do all these things, but I have no idea what to do now?
Yeah. And this again is where the chess clock and playing within a confined time, I think, in making real-time decisions is actually a really valuable skill to develop. I've played a lot on Tabletop Simulator, and it's not uncommon for the game to drag on for 4.5 or 5 hours. And it's also not uncommon for the peanut gallery to be feeding information through a WhatsApp to say, have you thought of X, Y, or Z? And that's not a real representation of an on-the-table game with a fixed amount of time. So certainly for me, it's like, what are the big decisions I need to make during the game? And this is to Darren's earlier point, keep it simple. What are the big things I need to get right? And let's focus on getting them right. And then the peripheral things, I'll try my best, obviously, but they're going to have less of an impact. So try and also mean they have less mental load, because every decision you make is obviously an opportunity for you to make a mistake, and then your opponent to capitalize on that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a bit about kind of play styles a bit. We have mentioned a lot of it already, Darren, if I start with you. People go into it thinking they need to play a certain way, and often, well, maybe this is generalizing a bit, but for those who haven't seen, shout out to the T-Sport Network guys who showed lots of the matches from the Worlds. But you see lots of people, I'd say less experienced people, doing lots of headlong flinging into, and it's kind of that Games Workshop start back to when you first learn, throw stuff in. Your play style is, would you say, you said it was proactive before, is that right?
Yeah. I'm not a very, go on, sorry.
No, please go.
Oh, well, I'm not particularly patient, and I know that about myself. So there's no point in me castling up. I'll castle up in deployment, but it's very much to explode out. And if I'm all up in my opponent's grill, because I'll try and play aggressively, they're under pressure, and I'm hopefully not under pressure. And again, it goes back to a very simple thought for me is, in any game, your dice will fuck up or your opponent's dice will fuck up. In all situations, that's better on their objectives rather than your own. So I'm more comfortable being a proactive player. I'm more comfortable asking the questions rather than answering them, because I'm not very good at answering the questions. I'm much better at posing them.
Yeah. So your strategy, your win, your kind of game plan is actually, you know, I want to be asking them as many questions, because you don't think for yourself that actually you being reactive would lead you to victory that much. Is that fair?
Yeah. But I can recognize when that isn't going to be particularly useful. So I'll give you an example. I was playing the Russian champ, Philip, on TTS, and he had the old Zinch. Was it the old change host? The one, but they could, I think it was not the very old change host, but the second iteration of them. It was my first TTS tournament. It was one of Owen's tournaments. And I'd just taken an army that had no wizards, no shooting. So it was just very basic, you know, move and fight. So it was two Phoenixes, I think 70 to 90 Phoenix Guard. And we're playing that long mission, whatever it was called back in the day. And my first turn, he gave me the first turn, obviously, because he's hoping to get a double. And he's looking to deny the double, you know, the classic stuff. So I didn't move. My first turn was, right, your turn. Because being aggressive in that situation, he would have been able to shoot the crap out of me. Earlier on in the tournament, I'd played a Zinch guy, a guy that had this wonderful chariot build, and I think he killed 50 Phoenix Guard in my first turn. I was like, fucking hell, Zinch are absolutely cooked. So I was very... And then I'd created, so in doing that, even though I wasn't being particularly aggressive, etc., I had asked the first question, which was, are you willing to come into my charge range with your shooting and allow me to potentially get a turn into you? But he hadn't really figured that out. So he didn't commit early enough, I thought. And then in the second priority, I won it and I gave it away. So, and then that happened for four turns, and then it suddenly dawned on him in turn five that I'm going to have to now make a move. So he teleported his 30 horrors onto my objective. He took my middle objective. So it's the one where the objectives get more and more as the game goes on, right?
Yeah.
So in this whole game, he'd managed to make one play because he was scared of my double turn, because I kept winning priority and giving it away to him. And then what happened was my 30 Phoenix Guard, like, killed all his pink horrors, but made, like, just got into the brims, let's say. So then in my turn, I managed with my Phoenix Guard that are on the flanks. They charged the center horrors, but they charged forward. So I was using the charge phase as a movement phase, let's say. So they were only tagging the sides on each flank, but going straight towards his objectives. My center unit finished off the horrors, so then I was able to then pile in 3 inches towards his home objectives. And then I won the turn five priority and managed to get my 60 Phoenix Guard onto his home objectives. So he burnt my middle one and got his 1 point, but I'd burnt my two that I kept for 8 points and two of his points for a point each. And then in his turn, he could only burn one for eight. So I'd won the game by not moving for four turns, basically. So it's a very... Did that all make sense? Because I'm not...
Absolutely. Yeah, because we mentioned before, remember in the deployment episode, about people find it very hard against shooting armies. And they think, oh my God, I've got to do something now. And actually, we mentioned before that... Well, Leo talked about when he won a game just by standing still and getting shot off, which isn't necessarily the most enjoyable gaming experience, but still won because they were shooting him and taking his models off, but he was just stood there.
So you don't have to make moves that are going to be to your disadvantage. You don't always have to do anything. Do what your opponent doesn't expect. So I think Philip was like, it's turn three. Are you really not going to move again? And I was like, yeah, because me moving gives you an opportunity to win. Me staying still means you've got to risk something. So even though on paper my army looked complete dog shit against this change host army, I'd managed to deploy and play in such a way that I'd mitigated all the advantages that they'd had. And it did require me getting a double into turn five. But that if that's my only way to win, then you do it. So you try and ask, try and play in a way that your opponent doesn't expect.
It's interesting that, like, you've made me think of, I played in a very similarly regressive way against Mike Stewart the other weekend. We played on the Vice, and my strategy going in was he's got four sharks, six eels, Volturnus, a king, and two units of thralls, and we're playing on the Vice, so it's going to be hard for him to get battle tactics because he's got no monsters. And like, I kind of went through it in my mind and had a think. And I had obviously 100 zombies in the gash. Now, four sharks and a king will just bang off. You know, he could take those zombies off as soon as he wants. So my plan was like what you've described, Darren. And I think it was still, I think I still needed to move a bit. But basically, I didn't move for three turns. And I just got my battle tactics, put my buffs up. Every turn, I just put six arcane bolts on the gash with a screen that was not. It screened him out so that if you charged into the 20 zombies, then you'd be within 3 inches of the gash at any point. So I'm just going to bolt off the king or bolt off whatever comes in.
Yeah.
Now, I think perhaps, and all the while, I was spectral grasping his boat so that I was half moving his stuff that was near his boat, which held him back a little bit. But he was inching forward, and picking things off with the shark shooting, which was still quite good. The irony was then that I played to win turn four prior. This was my whole plan. You know, I won turn three prior, didn't move into him just so he couldn't strike first, because what's the point? So we had this much like you guys have played the Vice. You know, it can be a bit of a Mexican standoff for a while. And then it was like he brought his eels in on turn. He brought six eels and two sharks into Nagash, or just outside of Nagash, into my screens on turn three. He blew them up. And then it was like turn four prior. I played to win turn four prior, and then it's go time. I'm going to put 60 zombies on the middle objective and fight his thralls and his characters and two of his sharks. And then I'm going to blow up six eels and two sharks. And guess what happened first spell after winning turn four prior?
You miscast, didn't you?
I did miscast. Now, I don't want to blame it on miscast, but... You know, like
plans. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I think I still got my battle tactic, but then the sharks, two sharks, did 12 damage to Nagash on my turn.
Yeah,
which was horrible. Livid. Maybe I should have just retreated away. But you've got to do something with your 1,000-point model, right? You know, you can't. So I think playing that regressive style, and you know, it goes to the episode. You know, the strategy, like I kind of understood what my overall strategy was for the first four turns, which was basically stand there, get my buffs up, hide my characters so you can't shoot them off, and then push at a turn four. That being said, maybe I should have pushed some screens up a little bit, pushed him back a little bit. But
no one's perfect, mate. Don't beat yourself up.
No, but I think I think another thing, we've talked a lot about pre-game, but post-game, it's really good. I mean, having some games streamed is helpful, but doing the Tony Moore notes, or even just like I keep, because I print off my own bespoke score sheets. Every time when I get home from a tournament, my Monday morning is coffee, and then I get the score sheets out and I look. I'm like, oh, I basically did these three battle tactics every game for the, you know, and then these were my ones, which I, you know, the killing ones, which I then did later. So I think whilst there's great amount of you know, pre that you can do. Definitely that reflection on the train on the way home, and you know, the next day, maybe having a chat with a pal who was there at the tournament. You can get a lot out of that. I don't know how reflective you guys are. Alex, one thing, what's your strategy? I think the people want to hear from you as well.
No one wants to listen to me, Owen, talking
yes,
all the nonsense.
Do. You're just as much of a star as any of us are stars.
Strategy. So. I mean, so very briefly, the time I played my most tabletop was 6th and 7th edition Warhammer to start with.
Okay. I glorious. Halcyon days gone by.
there were fantastic times, although for those who don't know, it was very heavily dominated by a few tomes, I should say. So it was the era
very heavy metal models as well.
Very heavy metal models, very demon and dark elf dominated, let's put it that way. Yep. So if you Google back to, God, what was it, Sam? 2012, 2011 roughly?
Vampires, dark elves, and demons were all on like 70%. They didn't do stats back then, but they were all in the 70% range, I reckon.
If they did stats, it would literally just look demons and dark elves just everywhere. And so if you look at the top 10 from 2012 GWGT, I think it was literally first, second, third were all demons, all the same demon list. And then 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th was dark elves, essentially. So it sounds awful, but it was fun.
Oh, what else?
I was pretending that I was...
Metabreaker.
but the reason I bring all that up is because I, as I mentioned with my collection that went to some lovely person out there for free, not that I'm bitter, is I play dark elves. Mm-hmm. And so I learnt... When I was learning the game, I used to use what everyone was running really at the time, which was a lot of core units, so lots of Dark Riders, lots of Crosswomen, lots of unkillable sorceresses with a stupid pendant that basically made her completely immune to everything. But it was very movement heavy, very movement heavy. Lots of it was movement. And yes, the 2 million shots obviously helped win games, but it was very heavily movement based. So I guess I learned playing tabletop miniatures around movement a lot. Mm-hmm.
Movement and wins game.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, deployment. So I tend to play or try and play lists or factions that have got a lot of movement because I find I get uninterested. And so my win condition, overarching plan to win games in general, is to try and get round to areas of the board where someone else can't get to. So, for example, an often tactic for Dark Elves against big kind of hammer, all your eggs in one basket units that you couldn't really touch, was to put a line of skirmishers in front of them and retreat. Because you could have charge reactions in 5th and 6th, so you would flee every time. And so it was just kind of feeding these mega units that you were never going to kill, you know, cheap crap, cheap chaff, whilst you go and win the game elsewhere. And so it's a bit like against these kind of god level characters, you're feeding them small units or little units. They can't be everywhere, and then you go off and win the game elsewhere. So my overarching strategy is to try and win in that movement. So I often gravitate towards factions that can do that. So IJ, Ideneth, I played it like quite a bit of in Sigmar. So yes, I think that's my strategy, and that's what keeps me interested.
I think you have to actually try and win as well. Like, that sounds really silly, doesn't it? But
no, you're 100% right. That was my downfall at Worlds. Is I was one damage piece away from being an excellent list. It's not enough to simply deny your opponent the victories. You also need to have the capacity to kill and score.
But I think
what was that piece, Sam? What was that piece, Sam? Out of interest, what was the clincher that would have changed it slightly?
If I swapped the Khorne Demon Prince, who was useless, with impassable terrain on the board. It's like there was no point having him when you can just create choke points with cheap units. If I swap the Khorne Demon Prince for the Contorted Epitome, that would then lean into the really strong artifact that the Legion have, the 5+ mortal wounds, give me reroll once to hit, which would be critical on Balakor. A number of turns, I went all out attack and inspired, so twos and twos with his eight attacks, and I rolled like 5 ones. And it's just like, that will happen, that you need to be prepared for it to happen, and you need to have ways of mitigating it. And the Contorted Epitome has this spell where D3 units, your whole army gets reroll ones to hit against them. It also makes any horrors that you summon significantly better because it affects their shooting. So, it was just a mistake. And in all of my games in Australia where we play area terrain, the Demon Prince was the best unit, and I would have said that was the first thing I picked even before Balakor. But in the games there, it wasn't. No, it wasn't remotely
useful. Comes down to experience, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I think, this is more relevant for singles as well, but you actively have to try and win. A lot of people try, if it's not going particularly well in the game, they will then try to lose well, and you get more podiums taking that 5% risk chance to win the game than you will taking that 75% chance to lose the game well. do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
If you're behind, you have to take more risks.
I think that comes from confidence, and you are a very confident player.
Because I've been in that situation so often. Absolutely. That comes from experience. But I think the people that are going to take the most from this style of content are the people that are just starting out on their journeys. Right?
Yeah.
Just to reassure you, you can make a play that was designed to win the game. It could be 5%, but it was the right choice, even though it's going to fail 95% of the time, if you want to, strive for those podiums. The people that actively try to win games, even in bad positions, even in bad matchups, are the people that succeed.
Well, and you always talk about your outs, don't you? That's the thing you mention all the time.
Just thinking about the point I made earlier about how reflective we are. Like, are you particularly reflective, Sam?
Mentioned
there about.
me and Darren are kin in a number of ways, but
do you still think of games from like fantasy from like 10 years ago?
I wake up
in the night and go, why did I fucking do that?
I won this the first time I won a big event. It was the in singles. I'd won a few teams events that were big, but that was just being carried by my mates. It was Face Off, so it was the Dwellers event. First time I won 100 mana, and I won by some margin. I think if I'd lost my last game, I still would have won the event. But in the last game, I played against my mate Tim, and he was running a Dog Star. So it was all vampires, mounted vampires, and then supported by hundreds of direwolves. And I had an opportunity to flank his bus and deprive him of, because then I could have thrown chaff in, moving his characters across, because there used to be a thing called Make Way, and the characters could move around in combat.
Make Way.
And, glorious. Anyway, I had an opportunity to deprive that. I didn't. I still won the game, but I often think about this game with Tim. I won the game and I won the event, but I'm still dirty on myself. And we still talk about it sometimes.
That is brilliant.
I'm going to be stewing tonight now. I'm going to have a stomach ulcer this week.
Sorry to put you back there, Sam.
Yeah. I've got something else, Alex, from like some earlier points that have just been bubbling away in my head. So if you are running a faction that plays fair Warhammer and doesn't have these bonkers battle tactics, and you're at a point in the game where you're in a bad spot, it's going to be difficult to get your battle tactic, then you can try and choose the one that's going to give you an advantage in a different way, one that you're likely to fail, but it's going to give you an advantage. So an example was in a Gargant game. This is when you could use Bring It Down and, you could kill the general or you could kill the battle line. So in this game, I couldn't leverage enough damage to take out a Gargan, I felt, if it heroic actioned. Okay. So what I did was I chose, so my real target was a Gargan. I was going to fail the battle tactic, but I chose bring it down on a different Gargan and then put all my resource into killing the other Gargan. And it meant that, so yes, I dropped a battle tactic, but my player was a Gargan down. And then in the next turn, I could choose Slay the General, because it was a general that I'd originally chosen. And now they could no longer choose Best Day Ever, because they'd already used it earlier on. So that's an example of how, if you can't get it, if you can't use a battle tactic, try and find a way that you can get an advantage from picking one that's not particularly good for you by trying to manipulate your opponent a bit. Again, does that make sense? Because every time I talk, we've got Owen and Sam in the chat who are so articulate. It always makes me feel rubbish.
If I can't understand you, Darren, I'll tell you.
I've got it all.
Yeah, it's all really good.
So we banged on a lot about how it's really important to get your five battle tactics, but sometimes that's impossible. So if it is, or you might not be a faction that can make use of these wonderful, easy ones. So you can center your strategy then around not trying to get all your battle tactics, but making sure you're using them so that you've got an advantage on the table, what's actually happening.
Well, that leads really nice.
Alex.
One
point to make, reiterating something that everyone said. All of us have spoken about avoiding temptation. So, Owen, you spoke about Nagash and throwing him in because he's the big guy, he's half your army, and there's sort of maybe a desire or a need to avoid temptation there. And then, Darren, you've spoken about you opted not to shoot the Gargant that had, or to kill the Gargant that was having his finest hour, because obviously they're getting the save buff. And I think quite often in, for lack of a better phrase, lower skill games, you're able to bait out people doing their thing. Like your army has a particular trick, or your army has a hammer unit and you want to use that. Your strategy is designed around it. So there's actually this thing, and it's a two-way thing, and it's a strategy of avoiding temptation. Avoiding temptation yourself, in terms of going the big play that you're not going to make, and then avoiding temptation in terms of exploiting it for them. So baiting them with units so that they get a bad trade and then you're able to kill the key piece or whatever it might be. And I think in terms of, you know, your segment, the plays, Stuart McCowan is, in my mind, the best person at doing this in the world. His win condition is often centered around letting his opponent utilize the thing that makes their army good and then him using that against them. Hard to describe in firm terms, but it's something that you'll see on the top tables where people like Stuart and also Jack Armstrong from what I watched on the Honest Wargamer and at Worlds, they trade up massively. What they give away for what they get back in return is always a really, really nice haul.
Who's the chap you mentioned then? Does he listen? Can we get
Stuart McCowan, the Iron Gutsman?
Oh, of course. I know him as the Iron Gutsman. I do apologize. Well, he needs to submit some plays then.
Yeah, I would say a little echo back to other themes within the show. Sam made me think there in terms of, you know, there's always like an angel and a devil on my shoulder. I don't know if anyone you ever used to read the Tintin books, but I'm pretty sure that like Captain Haddock always used to have this like little angel and little devil cartoon that would come up and, you know, drag them off in different ways. And I think every time I've made a play and in my gut, I'm like, this doesn't feel quite right, but it's like the aggressive thing to do, or the thing that I think I should be doing. Or it's the end of a really complicated decision tree, and I'm basically like wanking off and kind of going, look at how smart I am.
Can't wait to tell everyone how smart I am.
Yeah, exactly.
Seven buffs on, I better use them.
Exactly. Like, the classic, Sam, is let's let the dice decide. Oh, shit, I rolled a 12. I better make that charge. And like,
oh, you know, This cost me a game against Toby Meadows. I rolled a 12 to charge with my Furies, and my plan was absolutely to tag some Iron Golems, but the 12 got me onto his objective, and it put me within reach of his Varangard, and two Varangard just killed 12 Furies in an activation.
Oh, no.
And yeah, if I'd rolled anything, like even if I'd rolled like an 11, I would have got only the Golems and been in a far stronger position. But the 12 made me greedy. That hurt a lot.
So yeah, listen to that gut, understand yourself, and like your instinct, like you know, it's very you're very much playing on your instincts when you get into the meat of the game, right? Once mm-hmm. you've got through deployment and the first turn, and then those turns, especially turns 2 and 3, and you know, listen to the angel, not the devil, I would say.
Oh, that's Owen's top tip. Listen to the angel, not the devil. Just before we get to our Darren's favorite section, I thought we'd just end on top tips, which is nice because I think it's a nice tip from Owen. So, Sam, Darren, any top tips for listeners about strategy that you just want them to go away with? I'll start with you, Darren.
I think when you've got a horde of your army, it's tempting to try and sort of cover the board and think to yourself, I'm going to try and get every objective. What I like to do with a horde army is just cover enough objectives so that I've got an advantage and let my opponent try and get all the objectives so that you're leveraging more of your resources into less of theirs. So you can fight, if there are three objectives in the middle of the board, you can fight over two. You know, you don't have to go for all three, depending if the sexy objective's moving about, of course.
Yeah, you can make your board smaller for your advantage. You can focus it into your area, yeah.
So I quite often just play for, you know, two objectives or four objectives in a six objective mm-hmm. game, rather than try to fight for all of them. You don't necessarily need to cover everything.
Yep. Fantastic. Sam, last point's yours.
So I think fail fast. I think be willing to get your practice reps in and test things out, because that ultimately is where you're gonna make your learnings from getting practice games in, trying things out, and if they don't work, doing that work afterwards that Owen was talking about, and reflecting on the game is probably where you're gonna grow, and avoid the temptation. It's super easy. It's super easy to say, oh, my dice were dirty, or it's super easy to say your opponent had a hot dice, or it wasn't a particularly good scenario for your army, or whatever. You should avoid any of those narratives and just think about, well, what could I have done better? Where were there opportunities for me to score more points, or to maybe take that path to victory that slipped away?
Nice.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Right. Time's getting on. So we're on to our last section of this podcast, which people know what it is.
Me and Sam want Owen's top tip.
Oh, we had I thought Owen's top tip was Angel and the Devil on the Shoulder, but Owen, you're allowed another top tip if you like.
Was that a top tip? I thought
that was a Tintin reference.
I was taking Tintin as the top tip, but Owen, I apologize. Please do, if you have a top tip, Owen, rather than Tintin.
There's a lot of tease in there. Tintin's top tip. Go further with the idea of understanding yourself. You know, this is probably, I'm in a reflective period of my life anyway, so you know, you can't not take your personality to the table, good and bad. So understand yourself,
yeah,
and understand then also what your weaknesses are, and surround yourself with people who fill in the gaps. So you know, like, I know that I'm not the greatest list writer. So, you know, I'll send lists to Leo, or I'll bend Darren's ear, you know, kind of build yourself up, you know, kind of fill in the gaps around you with good people and friends. And, you know, they can then, what does it say? A rising tide raises all ships or something. So, you know, like, kind of learn together and, you know, like mm-hmm. basically lean into the community. Like
that's some. That's pyramid scheme, capitalist rhetoric. But it's also their scam artists.
Welcome onto our miscast Ponzi scheme, which I was just about to talk about.
Come on, I love where you can all invest. So.
Yeah.
For me to be part of the pyramid scheme, I do love my OBR. So, yeah, fair, it's fair, black fair. Pyramid scheme, okay?
And it's just a good time to mention my Patreon again, if anyone...
Yeah. If you invest in Miscast, you can speak to... Yeah, exactly. Right. Perfect. Thank you very much, Owen. Right, Darren, take it away.
The place!
Thank you very much. And it's not late at night, so you don't wake up any... Wake
no, but I'm going to wake up my hungover girlfriend in the bedroom.
You're like a cockerel, the Portsmouth cockerel.
Now, I'm super, super interested in hearing some of Sam's plays because I'm hoping they're as convoluted as I'd imagine, and also ones that he might have seen. So I'm going to just whiz through one that's been sent in by Francesco of Team Italy.
Yeah.
And I want to highlight this one. It's a very simple one, but it's something that I didn't know when I was playing Iron Jaws. And it's by their captain, Andrea. And also, I just want to highlight Steve Follows, what he said about the Italian captain. It was like watching someone play a violin. It was like, you know, listening to fine music.
So he listening was super, to jazz.
He was so impressed by Andrea's play that he's now considering an Iron Jaws army himself, just to give you an idea of like, and Stephen Follows is a very, very, very fine Age of Sigmar mind. So to impress him is bellissimo.
Bellissimo!
But it's a very simple one. So it's just, he had his Maw Crusher use Mighty Destroyers to charge into his epitome, and then in the movement phase, retreated away outside 3.1 inches. So the epitome wasn't able to, at the start of the combat phase, you know, on a 4+, make him strike last. And then because he'd charged, even though he'd retreated out, he was unable to pile in. And it's something that I could have made use of against Mike Stewart at Bobo when I mighty charged in my pigs. And then later on, I didn't do this because I wasn't particularly aware of it or wasn't thinking about it. Maybe Mike had put me under enough pressure that, you know, that play just wasn't on my radar, but I would have been able to retreat out 3 inches and then get more pigs into his skinks. So since reading this from Francesco, I've had sleepless nights thinking about how I could have done better against Mike Stewart at Bobo. But yeah, it's just a lovely little way that you can prevent someone's value from one of their key pieces. Right, it's a nice little cute little play. Well done.
Great. Thanks, Sam. Plays you'd like to mention to our listeners?
No, going back to our very first segment when you gave us a bit of a history lesson, we've got to use the same phrase, be prepared to be disappointed, Darren.
Oh, no.
I didn't prepare any. I didn't have any plays. I'll think of one. I'll write it into the show for a future episode.
Oh, no. Yeah,
that's fine. Absolutely. We'll get one written into the Twitters and we'll mention it across. It's fine. We can do some post show notes, which is perfect because it's extra content. So yes,
I'll let you off.
The post plays.
Owen,
I can talk about two probably. I mean, the first one, if anyone saw me reply on Twitter yesterday, was that Mick Wendell from Team Ireland did possibly the most fucking meta thing that you could ever do with which was that he killed his own Cronspine incarnate of Gurr by choking on somebody's purple sun. So I think that if you go to eat an endless spell and fail, then you drop a bracket or drop a level. So yeah, he went to power up and he powered down. Which I just, you know, that's kind of, with them being everywhere, I thought that was great. But I could talk about, I had one play last weekend, which I don't think was particularly fantastic. It was quite luck-based, but it was a pretty amazing set of, sort of circumstances. And I think it may be something that might be, you know, it goes to some of the themes that we've talked about this episode. So I can ramble on about a zombie based play if you like.
Yeah, please do.
So this comes very much from anyone who's played team tournaments, you know, scrapping for points. So this was against Gaia, who was part of the Norwegian team, and I was playing against his drone, you know, the whatever it's called, the Nurgle Air Force, essentially. I believe it was 12 of the Puskor Blightlords, a Lord of Afflictions, Bloab, and Festus. You know, quite a net listy aggressive. He made 2 12-inch charges and a 9-inch charge on his first turn after pregame moving, and I gave him some charges because I didn't want to be off the objectives. Anyway, we had a really good ding-dong of a game. I killed the Lord of Afflictions and 4 flies on the first turn. I turned the Lord of Afflictions into a zombie on the first turn, which was pretty fucking special. And it all came down, and we traded backwards and forwards, and in the end, he got Nagash, and he tabled me going into turn 4. He tabled me, which was pretty scary. And the only way that I could get any more points was through quite a lot of hoop jumping, a bit of luck. So basically, I went into my turn 4, and I rolled a 5. At the end of turn 3, I rolled a 5, and I brought back 10 zombies. So I had 10 zombies on an objective. We were playing on Survival of the Fittest, and the objective on one flank had been burnt, and so there was an objective in the center and an objective on the bottom left. I know we've got 3 minutes till the end of the show, so I'll keep it snappy. But essentially, he had 2 flies that were in the center, and that was the closest thing that was ever going to get over to these zombies. So basically, I took my turn, and I was like, I'm going to keep a range away from your flies so that even if you move your 8, you're going to be outside of 12 and you can't make the charge. So he did that, and that was fine, and I got my point. And then I then played for a late game 3 points, which was the only battle tactic I can get is a white dwarf one whereby you have to solo, you throw away your own unit. It's called something like Callous Overlords. So the way I did it was I moved my zombies up outside of 9 inches so that he couldn't redeploy 2 flies straight onto the objective and deny me, because I was thinking I need to get 1 point for the objective and 2 points for Callous Overlords. And that's going to, you know, give me a few points for the tournament, and maybe I won't finish last. So what it was based around was winning prior from 4 to 5, which I did, moving the zombies up outside of 9, then hard rolling a 9-inch charge. Zombies don't have a unit champion, so there's no rerolls available. I rolled an 11. Then were able to bubble wrap around the flies. They couldn't flying pile in onto the objective and deny me the objective point. They then did 1 mortal wound, and then the flies wiped them off. And it gave me 3 victory points, which was 4 victory points over 2 turns, just with 1 little summoned unit. And I felt really bad about it in the end, but everyone was crowded round because I got the sense that it meant a lot. And I was like, I'm going to scrap for these points. And it meant then through that one play that Gaia finished 1 point less than Mike Stewart. And Mike then went through to the semifinals and then inevitably onto the final. In the end onto the final. So
don't feel bad for playing as hard as you can. That's, you know, otherwise.
I played super hard with basically 0 models and I had to roll a 5
up,
win prio, then move up, then see the play, then make a 9-inch charge without any rerolls, then wrap
them. But it shows you that it can happen. It does happen. So start expecting good outcomes.
Yes, much like what you were saying about, you know, playing whilst I was losing, I was trying to win the last 2 rounds, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. You got everything out of that game that you could at that point.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So that was a zombie-based play.
Well, I also want to say that Mick has inspired our next the play section. Next time, we're going to ask for the misplays.
Yeah, absolutely. So next time, and Darren's alluded to it, next time we won't be doing the plays, we'll be doing the misplays. And I know everyone listening will have at least one of these. So we would quite like you to send in your misplays. So do send them in to Darren or Owen or the Miscast Twitter feed. Do send your misplays in. I had one more fantastic play, but I think we're going to run out of time. So what I'll do is I'll save it for our next episode because it's a long one, but it's a good one. It's really well written. So we'll save that for next time. So our next few episodes will be revolved around list writing, list building, which I'm sure people have got lots of opinions on, and playing on stream. And so we'll have some guests to come in and help us talk about those subjects. So all that's left for me to say is thank you very much, Sam, for coming on and giving us your insights about strategy. I think it's really useful, and I will retweet your lovely picture. So thank you very much, Sam.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me on, and I'd love to come back anytime you guys would like, if I warranted another
invite. Have you, mate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks, Darren. Thanks, Owen. And that's all that's left for me to say. Thank you, the listeners, for listening. And again, thanks so much for all your lovely feedback. It's absolutely heartwarming to see it all for all of us. So thank you very much. So do send in your questions. We'll try and answer them, even the piss-taking ones. So thanks again. Be kind. Look after each other. And we'll catch you all next time. So cheers. Bye-bye. Mwah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.